ready to rise above loud, angry headlines, longing for an alternative to the world's fighting and fear-mongering? Christianity Today magazine offers a trustworthy, faithful perspective on stories that matter to you, from the church next door to movements and ministries all around the world. Subscribe to CT for full access to in-depth reporting, insightful commentary, and redemptive storytelling, both online and in print. A subscription to CT also includes seasonal devotionals, special issues, and exclusive content. Visit orderct.com today or click the link in the show notes to get started and join a growing community of thoughtful, evangelical Christians who value different news that makes a difference. That's orderct.com to subscribe today. Hello, this is Russell Moore, and you're listening to The Russell Moore Show, brought to you by Christianity Today. Every week, we explore here conversations and questions from a Christian perspective to help you sort out how to live as a follower of Jesus in confusing times. This week, we have a conversation to seek to do just that. Y'all know on this show, we do a segment called So-and-so tells me where I'm wrong on whatever it is. This is not really one of those episodes because Kate Bowler is not on to specifically tell me where I'm wrong on a specific issue. But what I do think she does is to help us to think about where we might be wrong about the way we think about suffering. And particularly for those of us who sometimes, when other people are suffering, don't quite know what to do or say, or maybe we have said the wrong thing, she helps us to think about that. Kate Bowler is professor at Duke Divinity School, and she's a best-selling author of lots of books, including No Cure for Being Human, and also Everything Happens for a Reason, and probably prospectively, her new book will be a bestseller too, called Have a Beautiful, Terrible Day, Daily Meditations for the Ups, Downs, and In-Betweens. We've got a lot of things to talk about, including suffering, grief, ups and downs, but also prosperity gospel and all kinds of interesting things that Kate has been working on for years. Kate, welcome to the show.
Russell, I love that I've gotten to a point in my life where it creates an awkward pause in the bio where you're like, she's the author and I don't know. This is a lot happening. Let's just move on. That brought me joy. It is so good to finally meet you. We have a million friends in common. So.
We do. I know. And I can't tell you how many times somebody has said, have you and Kate met? And I'll say, no, not in person. And so here we are. So everything happens for a reason. You know, I want to start with, you know, the new book that's just come out, Meditations for the Ups, the Downs, and the In-Betweens. I'm wondering what your perspective is on a question that we have had a lot here in discussions. And that is, does right now seem to be filled with more anxiety and fear than before? Or is this just sort of normal life and a lot of us haven't noticed it till now?
Yeah, because as a historian, I want to say, you know, surely the emotional temperature goes up and down and it depends. We're not, you know, this is not, for instance, the 1860s. This is not the, you know, there are all kinds of fraught moments. But I do think that this is a moment with a particularly anxious tenor and that we feel the intensity of the human experience and our own connection and maybe our own fragility in a way we've never before. We've never been so mediated, maybe so divided in such a specific way, and so maybe unsure of what it means to use a common Christian language to address that feeling.
I like the word that you use, precarity. And I think that word is going to stick with me now. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. Precarity is such a perfect word. It means contingent, something that can be given and taken away. And for such a long time, I thought that precarity must inherently be a bad thing, or at least not a very Christian thing to feel that way. When I felt delicate, and I thought, well, surely I just have to get back to that place before where I felt durable. And then I read a wonderful comparison of the work of Dorothy Day, this Catholic reformer, and compared it with Reinhold Niebuhr, the amazing Protestant theologian, and both of their account of the word precarity. And Dorothy Day used it to describe the state in which we live as people of faith, aware in the world and yet delicate. And Reinhold Niebuhr described it in a way of like describing the delicacy of our world, but hoping that really we could just need to plow through with faithfulness and reasonable good conscience. And I was like, no, I think I'm on the Dorothy Day side. I think that if we're really honest, most of the things that build our lives are things that can come apart in any moment. And once we know that and can maybe live inside that with a little more honesty, we might begin to start to say different spiritual things than we did before.
You talk about in your book, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved, which we'll get to part of that a little bit later. But you talk about in that book some of the things that people can say in terms of reassurance that actually don't help. And of course, those who know your story know that several years ago, you were diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and went into treatment and had a bunch of people in your life speaking to you. I think there are a lot of people when they have somebody going through serious suffering, cancer, divorce, bankruptcy, or something like that, they're afraid they're going to say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
How does somebody work through that and be present for somebody if you think, well, I'm not an expert here and I'm afraid I'm going to say something wrong?
Oh, totally. Because we really do all say very dumb things. And that, I mean, I think maybe that's the right first step is just saying, I want to help. I will likely be and say every wrong thing.
Yeah.
But maybe one of the nice bits in that fear is realizing that you're just trying to figure out how to be yourself in this new context. And then and ask yourself, well, what kind of person are you? Are you the person who loves to rush in right away with the logistics? Everybody needs that person. That's the kind of, you should then, if you're that person, if you're preternaturally bossy, bless you. Email them and be like, on Wednesday, I'd love to drop off this, yes or no. Because people don't know what they need and they love a bossy friend. Yeah. Or maybe you're the contemplative type and you actually have an amazing spiritual life. Then you're the person who should remember. You should be the faithful saint who writes, like Beth Moore does this for me. She writes my name down and implores the Lord in a way that feels like she's got bonus points and I want them.
Right.
And like, if I've been held by people like that and I have felt the power of that. So if you're that person, write their name down and then send a little note in 6 months just to say, I've been holding you in prayer. I'm on your side. And then for everybody else, if you're like, well, I'm the funny one or I'm the just good at small talky one, great. Be that person. All you have to do is say, hey, I just want you to know, I know you're going through a hard time. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to. I'm just on your team. And then let there be a little pause. Maybe they answer. Maybe they don't. And then be yourself. Talk about sports. Talk about whatever. But like, then they get a chance to fit their personality in with yours. Otherwise, you might end up burdening them with having the same sad conversation 200 times and they actually don't want to talk about it ever again. Things that I have said or heard said to me that ended up being very dumb include the following. Any sentences that start with, well, actually, as if what I just said isn't true, and they're about to surprise me with new information about my life.
Yeah.
Well, actually, is never helpful. The comparison game is always a lot of fun but at least like I mean, it's like, well, but at least I could, you know, there could be stage 5 cancer. I could die in a different hospital system. I mean, I could have Ebola and leprosy. I mean, let's try. Everybody's aunt has almost always had what you've had and they're doing very badly. The ants of the world collectively have really been struggling this last year.
But isn't it true, though, on that one? I mean, I think about when Tim Keller was going through stage four pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
I would bring up actually your colleague at Duke, Richard Hayes, all the time.
Yeah.
Because it was a comfort to him to think about somebody else who, you know, has been through this for 7-8 years. And so it kind of wasn't a, I don't know if it was a comparison as much as it was, there is a picture of hope here. Is that always a bad thing to do?
Oh, I don't think so. Okay, to be totally honest, the worse my life gets, the more I go see Pentecostals because they are so hopeful. And sometimes you just need someone to be embarrassingly hopeful for you. And I remember I went to see this one pastor and they have this lovely practice called tarrying in the spirit, right? Where they pray, it's super unstructured, just kind of hang around. It's sort of embarrassing because sometimes you just don't know what to do after a prayer. It's like, do I open my eyes? Do I look around? But like, they just kind of sit with you and then maybe someone starts to sing or you kind of get in the groove of just having an experience. And at the end, he was like, hey, just, you know, my sister also has stage four colon cancer and she's your age. And he just put his hands on my head. He was like, sister, you're going to be fine. Mm. And he said it with so much love that it felt like even if I wasn't going to be fine, it was a gift of love. And those things can be really beautiful. I guess what's so tricky about hope, and this is really why I've been thinking about it a lot again this year, because I had so much chronic pain that it brought me back to a similar place whereas I'd been in cancer, where I had a very hard time setting goals, setting horizons, because I was struggling to get through the day. And I realized that it has made hope such a precious thing. When someone comes alongside you, what you're really asking for is, can you figure out what level of hope I can bear? If it's too much, I'll think you're delusional and you're not paying attention. If it's too little, I'll think, wow, you're maybe a little faithless. Don't you think God can do anything? And wait, I'm just supposed to do this by myself? And so I picture the friend as the person who just tries to sidle up beside you, evaluate how much you can tolerate, and just pour a little bit more in.
What do you do in those times that you just mentioned when it's hard to get motivated because of something that you're suffering?
Yeah.
How do you get beyond that, or do you just wait it out?
Right. Well, I mean, and all kinds of burdens have their own bizarre effect of sort of shrinking the room that you're in. Depending on what your problem is, the room can get very small. And the smaller it gets, the harder it becomes to manage the day without then making your life as small as your problem has made you. And so I find that what we're describing as a very it requires like a lot of wisdom because you're trying to really evaluate how much agency you have, how much choice is available to you, how much you can push into it. Because the truth is, if you don't like press the walls out, your life is going to collapse in at some point. And then you get the great disease of despair. And you will believe that things will never get better. And you will lie to yourself and others. You'll be like, nothing is as true as this pain or this problem or this. And in moments like that, then you're in a box. So I guess that's part of why I think so much about fear and pain is not necessarily because I am the largest bummer that I know, but because I'm always trying to come up with a theory of agency. How much can we tell people to try in a day, in a week, in a year? And what then can we ask of our Christian selves to kind of support that kind of trying?
That word despair is really striking to me, I guess, because I've been thinking about it a lot. Looking back at a time in my life, just evaluating the past several years, there was a time when I thought, you know, I was in the situation Walker Percy talks about in The Moviegoer, where despair is present because you don't know you're in despair. And I started to realize often there's such a gift in just being able to recognize what situation you're in, even if it's bad.
Yeah. I think what people are looking for is a contextualized, embodied story that says the Christian life is long and hard, period. But there's beauty and truth to be found, but it's going to look a lot less like I'm armored up.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/RussellMoore.
You talk about the fact that you could almost sum up your theology in the words, even so. Mm. What does that mean?
I guess I spent a long time almost dying. Mm. There was 1 year, and then there was another year, and it just kept going. And I kept trying to figure out, well, then, God, what do I believe if you're not going to make my life easier? Mm-hmm. What do I believe about you, about what Jesus came to do, what heaven is for? I just started thinking, well, what, God, can be true of you now? So then it just became, even so, even if I don't ever get a cure, even if my life doesn't turn out the way I hope, What will still be true? And I found that really winnowed down the number of promises to some, like, I thought some better mm-hmm. ones, you know? It's a lot less abundant life. I mean, unless I mean it metaphorically, which yeah. I think a lot, I think a richer account of love than I had before, and certainly a lot less me trying to earn my life.
Sort of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but if not.
Yes, that's beautiful. Yeah. There's this famous English professor, Reynolds Price, who worked at Duke mm-hmm. for a very long time. And he wrote in this one book that he got very sick, and that the colleagues on his floor that he like shared a printer with were the ones that had to take him to the hospital. And I remember reading this in a book group when I first got to Duke, when I first assumed that I was part of the glorious meritocracy of academia in which I would die among my many gargoyles. And I thought, oh, how sad. Like, what a lonely man. He has only his colleagues to take him to the hospital. Mm. Fast forward 6 years later, and I'm in my office, and I get the news on the phone that I have stage 4 cancer. Well, my family doesn't live in the United States. They are far away. And mm. actually, I most of my friends from grad school all moved away. So guess who took me to the hospital? Mm. It's all the people I shared a printer with. And mm. the feeling in the first 24 hours of people, oh my gosh, like I'll never forget the absurd tenderness of what you assume are like people that you really wanted to impress. Then mm. looking at me with so much love, I woke up with a quilt that one of my colleagues in Old Testament, Thea, had stayed up all night putting together for me, wearing socks I didn't put on myself. I had a friend who knew It was going to be horrible. And he wrote me a poem and then got it published just to make me laugh. It was about bats. Mm. And I saw my colleagues who I had really put so much stock in their, like, impenetrable wisdom as people who needed to carry me. And that was one of the most profound experiences of vulnerability I've ever had.
Yeah, because you're probably thinking, you know, when things go back to normal, we're going to be back at our normal sort of competitive and,
totally,
you know, disputes over who gets the printer or whatever sort of time. So you don't think everything happens for a reason?
Oh, my gosh, Russell, the amount of time we should spend on this is... I do feel that there are likely many cosmic reasons that I have not been made aware of, but that other people seem to have gotten more memos than I did, and yeah, sometimes in very reformed Q&A situations.
Why is that? I have my theories.
Can I ask you what your theories are? I'm very curious.
I think that there was a time in recent church history where becoming a certain kind of Calvinist, not a confessional sort of ongoing Presbyterian Calvinist or something else, but sort of becoming a Calvinist for some people was a way of saying, my home church was dumb. And a way to have everything that fundamentalism gives, mm-hmm, but with something that feels like it's more stable because it's more connected to church history and it has even more certainty. And I think that the really easily made Calvinists are the meanest. The people, yeah, who, I mean, I remember a guy saying to me one time, the problem of evil, what problem of evil? And so I think there's kind of a psychology at work there. What do you think?
Well, yeah, and I agree that it's a learned community. It's a people who love argumentation and, mm-hmm, a sense of history. The thing is, though, like, I am a church historian. Like, it's hard to weaponize Augustine in a way that I haven't read, enjoy, and am not aware of. But the bludgeoning with it suggests both a desire to put it in historical context, but also to assume a kind of, I think what bothered me was that it acted as if they were farther ahead in the Christian story, looking back at me, wondering, mm, why I thought heaven wasn't, mm-hmm, enough. And that's the, mm-hmm, bit of the story that I thought felt intolerable.
You know, the more I think about it here, I think one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't think I ever have articulated this, so I'm kind of thinking out loud, is, you know, I'm a moderate Calvinist, and that was completely different from the theological tradition that I grew up in. And it seems like there were two different directions. For some people, the Calvinism was a way of broadening. Mm. And that's what I saw it as, is this is actually taking me out into the great tradition and to something much bigger than just Mississippi Baptist revivalism. Includes that, but is much bigger than that. And I think for some people, it's the opposite. It's a way of narrowing, and I don't mean that in a moral sense, but a kind of a narrowing together in a remnant, mm-hmm, that's able to differentiate the true from the false, and that's largely cognitive. And yeah, that is, I think, some of what goes on,
yeah,
with the kind of Theo bros who are writing you. And I'll bet they're mostly bros, right?
On the other side, part of the difficulty with the Wesleyans and Pentecostals and those on the more perfectionist streams is I can also fail to die in the right way on that side. I can fail, mm, then to, as part of a process of sanctification, access God's power such that I learn to speak and use faith that would facilitate my healing, or at least some kind of abundance. So it was, it really felt like a bowling alley in which I was going to fall one way or the other. It was very hard not to feel like I was sick in the wrong way. The Reformed were very disappointed because I wouldn't learn the lesson, and the Sanctified were very disappointed because I wasn't using God's power. But the thing that I know now that I didn't know was the sicker I got and the sad, like the harder, the more impossible things became, the more God's unbelievable love bubbled up underneath me. And that had nothing to do with my ability to hold together sophisticated answers to complicated theological problems. There was just love. And so when people worry that they're going to run out, or their faith is going to run out, or their ability to tolerate difficult circumstances are going to run out, I would say, well, they probably will. But at that moment, I swear to you, that is one of the only promises I really came away feeling like we can guarantee, is that God's presence is assured when we are scared and lonely, or when we're unsure. And I guess that's what makes me sort of no longer afraid about, I guess I just don't feel like faithfulness is like quite as loaded a word as it was before. I think I really wanted to have the right answers, and I wanted to have like a well-built mind. But now I just feel like I know that underneath all of it is the fact that we will never be alone.
Mm.
And that
underneath are the everlasting one.
Yeah.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m. we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
You've studied prosperity gospel, and I'm not just talking about prosperity gospel, it goes well beyond that, but you've studied that. Why does that resonate or seem to resonate so much?
Well, it's possible that it's because we've kind of, I mean, in the song of God's story, I'm just doing piano hands right now. I hope that's very helpful to you, Russell. But in the Song of God's story, I think we have just like played the note of like justification, God has died for you, and like, which is a big one. But then it really became very quickly, Jesus has done all the terrible stuff so that we can have all the good stuff. And then it goes right into the like benefits. Now we're an Easter people. And I don't think we really know what to do like before we're an Easter people.
You've studied prosperity gospel. Is the future of Christianity, when you look at Global South and elsewhere, is the future of world Christianity right now prosperity gospel, Pentecostalism?
I would say that certainly Pentecostalism and neo-Pentecostalism and what I would think of as largely as soft prosperity has already won. It's certainly won American Christianity if you look at the percentages of like what most of the most successful mega churches are doing. And so that means that whether we're talking about the therapeutic benefits of Christianity or the healing benefits, we're really in a benefits model now.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly God wants to be a part of every part of our life. But I think we are worried. We're playing all of the brightest notes of that song now.
And what do you mean by soft prosperity gospel?
What I found was that the caricatures that people often think of as speak a word and then money will appear, that this very supernaturalist, immediatist version I call hard prosperity, in which there's a direct causal link between positive thought and health and wealth, and then there's a soft prosperity. Ones like just think of like a Joel Osteen or a Joyce Meyer, mm-hmm. or that if you think and speak in the right way, and you know, there might be something a little bit more roundabout, but then good things will always come back to you. Sometimes it can be as simple as like smile and the boss will notice you, but that good things will always come to those with faith.
And my theory, one of my theories is, and I wonder what you think about this, is that the kind of relationship that a lot of people have had with prosperity gospel, hard and soft prosperity gospel preachers has led to the very thing that so many people can't understand. So I'll have people who will say to me, why do these lower working class people who are trying to make rent, why would they gravitate towards somebody who's not just as wealthy as Donald Trump, but as garishly, audaciously wealthy? And I will often say, you know, Kenneth Copeland isn't being found out that he has a private jet.
Yeah.
That's actually part of the appeal.
Yeah.
Is this can happen to me, it can happen to you.
Yeah, we get in these very show and tell sort of theological circuits where like, well, how do you know? And I mean, and people can do it in ways like, well, look how big my church is. But we mm-hmm. often want to see then the fruits of the Spirit. And then it becomes a very materialist story. So how do you know that God is good? Well, what God has done for me, God can do for you. Therefore, equals jets. It does get to jets pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, it does get to jets fast. Did you see this piece that Simeon Zoll, I believe, did in Mockingbird Journal, looking at what kinds of churches actually do facilitate change? If you're just looking at observable change, addiction, those kinds of things, and you have the sort of a model that would say there's a cognitive answer. It's a theology and here it is. There are other churches that would have it's a sacramental answer mm-hmm. and here that is. But the ones that actually produced the most change were largely Pentecostal churches where there was this experiential mm-hmm. aspect of relatedness to God. Mm-hmm. Does that resonate with your work?
I guess, I mean, there's been a historic argument we call redemptive lift, in which the very radical claims that, say, a Pentecostal church will place on the newly converted are so much more stringent that they can really shape and mold. It's just, it's strong medicine. So they're going to then expect for, let's say there's an abusive man who's in a congregation with his family. Well, they're going to have a women's ministry for her. They're going to have wraparound Sunday school stuff for the kids and then camps. And then for the man, they're going to ask him to stop drinking. They're going to have like a strong, intense discipleship. Oh, wait. And now the family's finances are better. And now so there's a cascading effect of strong claims on congregants. And so the churches with the most sort of intense transformation stories often be the ones in which they expect the most, but then it's kind of what they call redempt and lift.
The subtitle, we've not talked about the ups a lot. We've just talked about
we've
the downs
about
and
the
tweeds. And I think part of that is because it's 2024.
Yeah.
And so there aren't a lot of people who would say, I'm having the time of my life. But there probably are some, and there's some listening to this. What sort of counsel would you give to somebody when things are going well yeah. and right, to keep a sense of gratitude and the right kind of precarity.
Yeah. Oh, because we get these beautiful seasons where we feel the wind at our back and we feel like we're walking on stilts. And if you're in a season like that, then like, bless that. Those are gorgeous moments in which we can often have bursts of creativity. We have the gift then of service, where what we have had given to us, we can give to others. Like those are great seasons. And there are also moments in which we get to recalibrate, that, you know, there are times of, you know, there's kind of an apocalyptic time. There can be a tragic time, but there can be the beauty of ordinary time. Like, you get out into nature, you start to be weird about how skunks actually look really nice in the night. If you're in Canada in a pandemic and your name is Kate, and you get talk to everyone about skunks for a full week. You regain the act of noticing, of reminding yourself of the beauty of the ordinary world. It's a great place to know God in a more detailed way. So I think that's right. The act of cultivated attention, of gratitude, is a really good one in a season like that. But not gratitude police. Like, you're allowed to be sad anytime you want to. It's fine.
You know, Buechner said, when you find tears in your eyes, pay attention to that. And it often tells you a great deal about yourself. And I was noticing the other day that tears come to my eyes every time that I see, of all things, the series finale of The Office.
Oh, that's nice.
Which I have seen far too many times to even recount here. But the scene when, at the end, when Pam starts to say, you know, I don't know why you wanted to look at a paper company, but I've started to realize that there's beauty in ordinary things. And Jim is talking about how all of these things he can see happening in his life. And every time I'll tear up at that. And there'll be these moments when I'll just sort of, and yesterday was one of them. These moments where I'll be sitting at the table and I'm taking everything for granted. And I just almost stepped back and looked almost as an observer. And there's just so much for which to be grateful.
Yes.
And I just don't pay attention to it enough.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. It's how I feel about my 10-year-old. Like, God has given no one greater freckles than his nose. And, like, he made a whole outfit out of paper towels the other day.
Oh.
And nothing feels like holding a kid in a towel. Just nothing. So we get given these really surreal moments where we have to slow things down. We get these seasons where we're begging God to speed things up. But like, none of them are a surprise. It's just the different notes of this song. I think we just feel a little silly singing it sometimes. But I'm trying to get used to the fact that maybe there'll be a little more scope, a little more range, high highs, low lows. And this is the human condition.
The book is Have a Beautiful Terrible Day, Daily Meditations for the Ups, Downs, and In-Betweens. Kate Bowler, I just so enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
This was fun.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosper. Host, Russell Moore. Producer, Ashley Hales. Associate producers, Abby Perry and Mackenzie Hill. Director of Operations for CT Media, Matt Stevens. Audio engineering provided by Dan Phelps. Video producer is Abby Egan. And the theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.